last two of the four points, which is the end of how to get rid of the Gelkin. What's Gelkin mean? What are you going to call it? Like obstacles. Okay, those are like obstacles to getting what? Bodhicitta. Okay, so we're just reaching the end of how to get rid of the things that could block you from getting bodhicitta. And then about a third of the way through the class, we'll get to collecting all the positive energy you need to get bodhicitta. So we're still at the end of the bad, getting rid of the bad energy that you have to get rid of.
You don't
have kind of an overhead. Nyambo means antidote. We'll spell it when the replacement bolt comes. We can do the sound right now. We don't get it. Nyambo. Nyambo means antidote. It's the third course in the order in which it's taught by Master Chan. The third course is called antidote, the antidote course. It's something you do to make up for what you did before. Okay, Nyambo couldn't do it. And at this point, you know, Master Chan has already told you that you could use as a Nyambo. So, he actually gets into the concept of a Nyambo. In Buddhist philosophy, in technical philosophy, like the Perfection of Wisdom text, Nyambo is very specific. Nyambo means one thought that cannot coexist with another thought. Like they say, this town is too, what do you say? This town ain't big enough for both of us. And Nyambo does the idea of Nyambo, like two thoughts cannot coexist in the same brain at the same time.
Technically, the idea of Nyambo is taught in the Perfection of Wisdom, in the Abhisamalankara, in the first chapter. It's very beautiful, it's very long, and it's thought that cannot coexist with other kinds of thought. The ultimate Nyambo is the perception of emptiness, understanding emptiness. Even intellectually, not even just directly, but also intellectually. And it acts as a Nyambo for all kinds of mental afflictions. Like, once you understand emptiness directly, once you have the understanding of emptiness in your mind, and your mind is focused on it, you cannot have a bad thought. It's impossible. So the ultimate Nyambo is understanding emptiness. And in fact, there's this debate in the monastery, you know, Korwa La Chime Ka Ayu, which means, does samsara have an end? You know, can you prove that samsara has an end? There's a debate about korola na meta aya means, did samsara have a beginning? What do you say? Korola mugita aya. You say me.
Me.
Me ata. Me te, why not? Then you say, why not?
Guya.
You mentioned?
Yeah.
You can say that because the causes are endless. You cannot point to a time in samsara or in your suffering that didn't have some suffering before it to help cause it. Some mental affliction before it to help cause it. Ultimately, you can prove that samsara doesn't have a beginning. You know, chimeta ayu doesn't have an end. Yaha. You think? Why? Nyambo top den yevechen. Nyambo top den yevechen. And that is the answer that they give them. You know, after hours and hours of debating, it comes down to Nyambo top den yevechen. Say Nyambo top den yevechen. Which means because there is a powerful antidote to samsara, there is an end to samsara. And that's the argument. That's the whole argument. You know, your suffering will have an end. Samsara, or the cycle of life, cycle of suffering for you, will have an end. Why? Nyambo yevechen. Because there's a powerful antidote. And that's the perception of emptiness, or the understanding of emptiness. You cannot understand an object's emptiness and also have a mental affliction towards it at the same moment. Impossible. Totally impossible. Very interesting. And I'm not talking about direct perception, much less direct. Because when you're in a direct perception, you're sitting there in deep meditation and you're not jealous of anybody or angry at anybody. You can't be because you're not having any thoughts at all, normal thoughts. So I'm not even talking about that, but I'm talking intellectually, or if you're focusing on a person and understanding their emptiness fairly well, it's impossible to have a mental affliction. And that's why the fourth of the five paths is the science of using your understanding of emptiness to wipe out your mental afflictions forever. And when you finish that process, you've reached nirvana. Okay. So that's the idea of Nyambo in scripture, in philosophical scriptures. But when we get to Master Shantideva and the Bodhisattva Charavatara, it's a little bit different. And he says, if you're going to understand antidote, you have to understand what? What do you guess? If you want to understand... illness. Yeah. Okay? Illness. Like, if you want to understand what antidote is, you have to understand what sickness is. You know, what is the sickness that is being cured by this antidote? So then he gets into, when he discusses the third force, he gets into the concept of illness, spiritual illness. And it's very interesting. He says, the big illness that we have, and this is on your homework, is duksum. Say
duksum.
Duksum. Duk is not duk, okay? It's not the duk in dugyal, and it's not the duk in to exist. It's duk. Third column, no prefix letter, no head letter. Duk means poison, alright? Duk means poison. D-U-K, okay? You can spell it any way you want on your homework, and they can't take it off this time, right? Duksum, S-U-M, okay? That means three. So it's the three poisons. And this is the disease that we have. The main disease is the three poisons, and then they cause 84,000 variations of mental afflictions. Okay? So, but basically it boils down to three poisons. Why are they called poisons? I mean, obviously they hurt you. But the other idea is that they're insidious. They're in your mind all the time. They're like poison running in your blood. You know, they're like having some kind of leukemia or something where there's a basic problem with your blood. You know, the point is that they are circulating throughout your mind constantly. At every moment, they are circulating throughout your mind. Okay. And it's like a blood disease or something. It's like something wrong with your spiritual body that's insidious. It's there all the time. You have it all the time. So the first implication of poison is obviously that it hurts you. But the second implication is that you have some kind of spiritual blood disease that it's always with you. You always have it. There's something wrong with your mind that these three are always poisoning your mind at any given time. I think the third implication of poison is that if you could get rid of them, you might feel really good. You know, the idea is that you've always had them. And we don't even know what it would be like not to have them. And you get a little taste of it if you start to practice. So he describes those. I'm going to go into the idea of the duksum. I like to get into things that I call them dharma rumors. Okay, I like to attack dharma misinformation. Okay, they call them, people translate these as attachment, aversion, and ignorance. I think it's a lousy translation. The last time I had attachment was when I was a vice president at work, and they were talking about getting rid of me. You know, the last time I had aversion was like when children tried to give me eggplant, you know. And ignorance, okay, maybe I had that worked off. But they are much more subtle than that. You know, if I say desire or attachment, you think of some major attachment you have, like to your car or your house or your wife or whatever. I mean, but these three are supposedly flowing through your mind constantly, on a constant basis. So I think aversion is too strong. Like, I can't say that I've had aversion for at least 20 minutes now, you know. But if it's one of the three poisons, it's been in my mind all the time. It's in your mind. It's occurring in your mind every few minutes, or every minute or so, or even more frequently. So I think you have to study the definitions of them. I'm going to give you the definition just of the of desire to start with. By the way, I prefer to call them liking things, disliking things, and ignorance. Okay? And I think if you're going to be even more exact, you should say disliking things ignorantly, liking things ignorantly, and then ignorance itself. Because not every kind of desire or wishing something would happen or liking things is bad. And I think that's a Dharma rumor. You know, like, they, you see this guy sitting meditating somewhere in this nice robe, and he's supposed to not like anything, not dislike anything, and not be ignorant, you know. So you say, well, do you like suffering? Do you like, are you supposed to not like nirvana? Are you supposed to not like Buddhahood? Are you supposed to be, I mean, it's a spiritual goal. It's why you came to this class is to learn to not like anything. or learn to not dislike anything at all. You know, is that what the three poisons are? You know, is that what liking something means when it's a poison? Is it true that a Buddhist, when they get really good at being a Buddhist, is not supposed to like anything? Really? Is that, does it make sense?
No.
It doesn't. I mean, for several reasons. I mean, first of all, obviously you're supposed to like other people. You know, bodhicitta is liking other people. You're supposed to like nirvana. You're supposed to like Buddhahood. You're supposed to like getting tantric enlightenment in this life, you know. I mean, it's not that you're not supposed to like anything. Now, what about ice cream? Okay, or pizza? You know, can you like ice cream or pizza? Now, we have to talk about it. Okay? Is that wrong for a Buddhist to like certain kinds of food? Yeah?
But isn't there liking with an attachment to it? And that's the it's karma, everything is thought. And samsara is based on the continuum by having those continuous thoughts, those internal continuous thoughts. Then there's got to be something to there.
Oh, I'm not saying, I'm just asking. But when you say attachment as opposed to liking, okay, like I know what you're saying. Some people would say it's okay to like pizza, but it's not okay to be attached to pizza. Okay, no, seriously, an attachment to me means would I want it over and over again? Or would I get upset if the pizza shops in New York are closed, you know? And people say, a Buddhist can like pizza. Like, obviously, the Dalai Lama has a good time when he eats. You know, if you've ever eaten with the Dalai Lama, or I saw him listening to Richie Havens one day, and he was like, you know, and he seemed to be liking it, you know. But what you're saying is that to want to like it again and again is what a Buddhist is not supposed to do. And I say it's not true. You know, I mean, a Buddhist, the reason you collect good karma is to have pizza all the time. You know? Seriously. I mean, if attachment means wanting it to happen again and again, we have to talk about it. We'll talk about it. But to me, attachment means wanting it to happen again and again and being upset when it doesn't happen. And I say the same thing. I think if a person takes that to its logical extreme, then we would just be sitting here, and whether or not we got pizza, we would still feel the same. And is that what we're trying to reach, you know? Are we trying to reach a world where pizza runs out, but you still feel okay? Seriously. Because the difference between wanting pizza and being attached to pizza is that. Wanting means it's okay to want to have a nice meal tonight. Attachment means I want it to happen over and over again, and I get upset when it doesn't happen. And the logical extreme of both of them is that we would learn to sit here and not really care much whether or not we had pizza. You know, like, if pizza came, we'd be happy. And if pizza didn't come, we'd just kind of cruise, you know. And is that the goal of Buddhist practice? That's the question. Is that the goal of Buddhism? Is that what we want? Do you want to reach a state where you could sit in your home and just be equanimous no matter what happened? You know, is that the goal of Buddhism? I'm asking, because I think it's a Dharma rumor. I think people say, people say that differently. You know, they say, I feel guilty. Americans love to feel guilty, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, they're always looking for something to feel guilty about, you know? Like, I feel guilty because I like pizza, or I'm attached to pizza, or I get upset when I don't get pizza. You know, or Arizona iced tea, or something like that. You know? Is that what we want? Is that where you want to be? That we're going to talk about it. Not be attached. No, I understand your argument, but I'm just saying, according to that, then, non-attachment is what we want to get, and not non-liking, right? You can still like it, but don't get attached to it. And attachment means you get upset, or you expect it to happen again, something like that. To me, that's what attachment means. We'll talk about it. Bentano. Ah, good question. There's a huge debate in the opening chapters of the Madhyamikavatara of Chandrakirti. And he defines three kinds of love. And the highest kind, which is the opening line of Tsongkhapa's mantra, is what? Mikmetsewa means, literally the words mean love that doesn't see anything. Mik means eye, and the verb means to see something. So that the opening lines of Jetsun Kapa's mantra is Mikmetsewa, which means you have a love like Avalokiteshvara, and it doesn't see anything. It's like, so what does that mean? And then Chandrakirti explains that is a kind of love. It's the highest of three kinds of love, and when it looks upon a sentient being, it sees that sentient being's emptiness. And understand its emptiness as it loves them in an ultimate way, compassionate way. So yeah, we're talking mental afflictions can't coexist with perception of emptiness, but love, compassion, must coexist with the perception of emptiness. So it's not like when you focus on a person's emptiness, you can't feel any emotion at all for them. That's not the case. It's that if you understood their emptiness, you couldn't have a mental affliction towards them. So we're going to go into the definition of... do you have a question? No. Poison? Oh, there's three kinds, and that's the highest kind. Okay. In the first chapter of that book. In the opening line, actually. Okay. Nice. Your karma continues to improve. And your old... You must have purified this. I'm going to spell the third power that we didn't, the third force. Okay, that Duke Sum is the three poisons, okay? To resolve this question, by the way, if you want a nice picture of Duke Sum, where do you go? Wheel of Life, okay? There's two versions of the Wheel of Life. There's the new one and the old one. Okay, and the new one, and the later one, what are the three representations of the three portions in the Wheel of Life? In the center. Ignorance is pig. Desire is a rooster. Liking things is a rooster. Liking things ignorantly is a rooster, okay? Outside. Liking things ignorantly is the rooster. And disliking things ignorantly is the snake. Okay. But in the old pictures, and you guys studied it in the Vinaya, and it's prescribed in the Vinaya. The Buddha taught it how to draw it in the Vinaya. It's one of the three places where he taught how to teach it, that I know of. What did he say? Yeah. You see, in the new pictures, the tail of one is connected to the mouth of the other and like that. And it goes in a circle. And that has its own significance, which is good. They tend to perpetuate each other. But in the original, in the Vinaya, the pig, out of the mouth of the pig is coming the snake's tail, and the pigeons, in the Vinaya it's a pigeon, because pigeons, I guess, are very desirous creatures. And that's supposed to be, according to Ken Rinpoche, that's a better way to show it. Because ignorance is at the root of both of them, or at the other two. Why did we get into this? We're discussing spiritual illness. Why did we get into that? We're discussing the third force. Because we're talking about antidotes. You know the six antidotes. that those are to fix that spiritual illness of the three poisons. So you have to know what your condition is. I'm going to give you, this is a little difficult, but I think you'll like it. This is the technical definition. Like, I have not used these definitions much. When you get into Buddhism more deeply, it'll be a lot of fun, and we'll use all the monastic textbooks. And this is the technical definition from the monastic textbook for liking things ignorantly. Okay, one of the three poisons. And I think if you get that definition, you can extrapolate it to the other two. All right? Just memorize this one. It's worth it. You know, it's like a mantra or something. This is the answer to all those questions we were asking. This is the definition. This is the technical definition of what they call desire. Say, Bakche? Sorry, is there a Google up there? Yeah, Dirchak is saying. Definition of, all right, Dirchak here. This is the Tibetan word for what they call desire or attachment or whatever. Okay, this is the, this whole long page is the definition of Dirchak. There's Dirchak. All right. You guys have flat karma tonight. By the way, if anybody wants to come up during the break and look at the transparency, that's okay too. Okay, let's go through it. Say sakche.
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 Sakche means impure. Impure. And there's a huge debate in the Abhidharma Kosha, because the opening lines of the Abhidharma Kosha are Chinam Sakche Sapame, Lama Sope Hitching, and Sakche Kamche Keda La Sanukum Gita. And Sakche means impure, and it means anything having to do with the mental afflictions. Produced by mental afflictions, instigating mental affliction, or made of mental affliction. It's a huge debate about it. In the higher schools, sakche takes on different meanings. Anyway, you can think of it as impure. Sakche ki nirpo. Nirpo here means thing, an impure thing. Sakche ki nirpo means an impure thing. La yidu ong. I'm sorry, Yiwong. Yiwong stands for Yidu Ongwa, which means attractive. Attractive. Pretty. Nice. Okay. Yidu Ongwa means comes to the mind. And it means attractive. Nanwa means looks that way with the implication what? It's not. Okay. Appears to be. Okay. When you say he appears to be your friend, you're implying is not really your friend. Okay? So nang ne means appears to be. So the elements we have so far, if you translate them into plain English, means that something which is actually impure is appearing to you as attractive. You have to decide whether this fits a pizza or not. Okay? Something which is in actuality impure is appearing to you as attractive. That's the first element of what we call liking things ignorantly, or what you've always heard as desire in Buddhism, okay? Or attachment in Buddhism. Rangtoki means under its own power. You can say independently. In the study of Buddhist psychology, Rangtoki is a very special expression that means this mental function does not rely on other mental functions for it to function. In other words, there are certain mental functions which can only appear in your mind if other mental functions are assisting it. Rangsobgyen means this mental function is pretty strong. This mental function can go on its own. I was afraid you'd ask me that. I'll look it up. I've never heard a really good explanation. But anyway, Rangsobgyen, I think feeling. I think feeling has to be connected to other ones, okay, to occur. Alright, Rangsobgyen. Midjowa. Midjowa means doesn't want to lose it. Doesn't want to lose it. Jowa comes from, can I rip a page?
Yeah.
There's a verb, there's an ancient verb in Tibetan called Shrelwa, listen. That's Shrel. Okay, and then it came into later language as Chel.
Okay.
Chel. This is Michel, to be separated from something.
Okay.
So in common English, in plain English, it means to lose something. Okay. Those of you who are studying Tibetan, this is really bad because Ndel means what? Ndel. Jal means to be connected to something. Tibetan origination is Tendel. Take off the prefix letter Jal, meaning totally opposite, completely opposite, to be separated from something. So be careful, if you're translating, you might get the opposite. Okay? Different spelling. Ndjoa, Dupe means wants to. So Ndjoa, Dupe means wants to not lose the thing. Wants to not lose the thing. Doesn't want to lose the thing in normal English. Okay. So what do we have so far? Something which is actually impure is appearing to be attractive, and on its own steam, this thing doesn't want to lose it. Okay.
You don't want to lose?
We didn't get to the thing yet. We didn't get to the who doesn't want to lose.
Okay.
That's Semjung Semba. Okay, Semjung means a mental function. Semjung means a mental function. Depending on what school of Buddhism you're in, there could be 50-something or 60-something. But anyway, it's the discrete different mental functions. Like jealousy is one of the mental functions. There's, in one school, Kundro La, which means five mental functions which accompany all states of mind. In another school in Abhidhamma, they call it Sengi Sammanchu, and there's 10 mental functions that accompany all states of mind. But for example, feeling, the capacity for feeling, is always running in your mind. You never lose it. You always have it. You may be feeling neutral, but you're not feeling. And that's a mental function. There are different schools have different numbers of mental functions. They're discussed in like the second chapter of the Abhidhamma Gosha. So Semjung means mental function. Semba means a thought in the mind. And we know, Semba is what? What's a synonym for Semba? Karma. Karma. Anytime the mind moves this much, that's karma. Lele jikten natoke, deni semba dambeke. The opening lines of the fourth chapter of the Abhidhamma. Lele jikten natoke. The universe comes from karma. Deni semba dambeche, and karma is semba. Anytime your mind moves, that's karma. 64 karmas in a finger snap. Okay? That's, so the full definition of desire. If we get the definition, then maybe we can argue whether or not pizza, wanting pizza or being attached to pizza is bad for a Buddha, you know? So here's the definition. It's a mental function wherein you think on your own accord, meaning we don't have to worry about that too much, that something which is actually impure and which appears to you as attractive. Okay. I'm just doing it ad hoc, okay? That you don't want to lose that thing, okay?
The thing or thought.
Well, we'll do it again. It doesn't really matter, but anyway, it's a mental function or a thought that doesn't want to lose I'm just changing.
You can't get it.
Off the top of my head. Doesn't want to lose something which is actually impure, but which appears to that thought and attract it. I mean, it doesn't matter how you phrase it. You get the main point. It is a thought. It doesn't want to lose something. And that something is something which is actually dirty but seems to be nice. And those are the three elements. Okay. Those are the basic three elements. Now, go back to pizza. Okay? if pizza starts taking your food. I always define sake kingopo as honey on a razor blade. Is pizza honey on a razor blade? You can eat it, you can get fat, you can get...
Whether it's good or bad, it's both good.
Ooh, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a pretty good answer. Is pizza a dirty object? Is it an impure object?
No.
Yeah, it's carrots and chicken. So pizza in a blue suede. That's true, so there's no pizza in a blue suede.
There's no
blue suede. There's no blue
suede.
Basically, sake kingopo for us means something that can make you miserable. Something which always changes to bad. That's a sake kingopo. I mean, every good thing in our experience, if you are who you seem to be, turns to bad. Because the karma which created it wears out. Always. Always wears out. That's a sake kingopo. So if pizza could wear out, you know, if you could eat a pizza and then you know, 8 slices disappear, and then there's no pizza, then it's a sake kingopo. Okay. Meaning, if the karma to experience that good thing could wear out, and you could lose the thing, and that's the, if the pleasant taste of pizza could turn to hunger, then pizza is a sake kingopo. Then pizza is an impure object. And the Abhidharma says, the lama tope jichin of sake. Every single object in the world which changes is impure, except for the lamp, except for the spiritual path. Anything else that changes is suffering. Anything else that changes is a sake-taking loop. We're talking from far, okay? Yeah. Yeah, offering for this time. Pizza as an offered thing, but then it's the mind, it's the mental offering. Offering pizza is part of the class. Okay. Eating pizza is structured and offered. Yeah, you can eat it and offer it. Okay. But basically, we're talking about desire should be focused at a thing which is going to hurt you anyway. Desire should be focused at a thing which is going to get turned bad anyway. And that's why we say ignorant. It has to be ignorant. You want something that can never be. You want to get something nice out of this object. It cannot happen. Because it will wear out. That's very important. You know, don't settle. The Sakyapanda just said, the Kepa Lobe Duna Dewa Duna Kemisi Dewa Chuna Chapayi Dewa Chuna Pomeo. Meaning, don't get attached to small pleasures. You know, don't get attached to pizza that you have to keep going out and buy over and over again. And it makes poop and all that stuff. You know, try to get a pizza which is pure pizza. And there is such an object. I mean, when a Buddha perceives pizza, I guess, it's just a totally pleasant thing, and it does not change. It does not change to hunger. It does not change to... some kind of empty feeling that, oh, the pizza's all gone or something like that. It does not change for them. I don't, by the way, they don't need food. They don't eat food. So whether or not there's a pizza, maybe you just sit there and look at it, I don't know. But, But first of all, the object that you have desire for should be something that could never make you happy anyway. Because whatever nice thing you try to get is being created by imprints flowering in your own mind, which will wear out, and you'll lose it. And that's a sakshaking rupa. And that applies to every good thing in our lives, except for spiritual things. According to Abhidharma. Oh, we'll talk about it. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about it. Okay? You own the Nung name means, in your mind, it looks very nice. You know, in your mind, it looks like something worth getting. Okay. Did you have a question? No. In the Abhidharma, it's three things are called impure. Things that are created by mental affliction, like our body. If they're created by mental affliction, they're called impure. If they are mental affliction, they are impure. First one could be physical, mental, or neither. Second one is mental. And if they trigger mental affliction, they're called impure. And then there's this huge debate, like if a bad person looks at the Dalai Lama, is the Dalai Lama impure? That's another question. Okay, anyway, we won't get into it. If you get angry at the Dalai Lama, is the Dalai Lama impure? You know, that's a big debate in the Abhidharma. Okay? Don't worry about it. But the process is like this. And this you have to understand about desire. Desire has to work like this. It has to misapprehend its object. It has to be mistaken about its object. It has to look at that object and not understand it.
But at the moment you were experiencing it, you don't know it.
Yeah, normally. What does it mean to misunderstand an object? Let's take pizza, okay? Dear to my heart. What is the difference between liking it ignorantly and liking it intelligently? I think that's the big question. You know, you have all the parts here now. You know, what's the difference? Yeah. He said knowing that it changes. Okay, is knowing that it changes would imply that the ultimate misperception of pizza is to think that it was permanent. Is that the ultimate misperception of pizza? To think that it's permanent. It is, by the way, a spiritual obstacle. It is what we call a lower level spiritual obstacle. Impermanence is what we call a lower level spiritual obstacle. But what is the ultimate misperception of pizza? It's to think that it's self-existent. Okay? And then we can go through the three schools, different presentations of what does it mean for pizza to be self-existent. But we'll skip to the higher school because we ain't got much time. Okay? Higher school says, when you perceive pizza as anything other than being your own projection forced on you by your past karma, then you are misperceiving the pizza. Okay? I'll say it again. Higher school says, if you look at pizza and fail to understand, I should say it differently. If you look at pizza and you think that it came from anywhere else, but from a projection from your own mind, which is forced on you by your own past karma, then you are being ignorant about the pizza. And then you can have what about the pizza? Then you can have a mental system about the pizza. Then you can have desire. Then you can have stupid desire. Okay? Then you can have stupid desire about pizza. I'll say it again. You can only have stupid desire about pizza if you see pizza as being self-existent. Or you could say it in another way, if you don't understand the emptiness of the pizza. What is the emptiness of the pizza? The emptiness of the pizza is that it is anything except something which is not, double negative, okay? Which is emptiness. Emptiness is always expressed in that way. And I'll get to that in a minute. Okay? If you think it's anything except, I shouldn't say that. Anyway. It is not anything except your projections forced on you by your past karma. And if you see it any other way, you are seeing the pizza as self-existent. And then you can have a mental affliction about the people. Yeah. Yeah. And I'll tell you why. You have to get the punchline. You must get the punchline. If you understand its emptiness, you understand its dependent origination. Its emptiness is that it was never anything except your projections forced on your past karma. Its dependent origination is, it is a projection forced on you by your past karma. And once you understand its emptiness, you understand its dependent origination. Once you understand its dependent origination, you can't have desire for it. Very interesting. Because stupid desire implies that you would hurt someone to get it. Okay, it's like four steps. And this is in the Madhyamika scriptures. You know, acting ignorantly, collecting bad karma, you got to do all these things have to be there. You have to misunderstand the object. You have to think, this pizza exists externally and is not my own possession. And then you have to want it. And then you have to be willing to do something to get it that is immoral or unethical. And then you can collect bad karma. And you can't have bad karma without thinking it's self-existing. Because if you understood it, you would never collect bad karma. Because where did the pizza come from? What is the pizza? What's the dependent origination of pizza? It's your projection. Forced on you by your past karma. Okay? That, if you want to get pizza, how to get pizza? Get pizza. I'm very good. That's a bad one. I'm making a vow. That's one of the five wrong livelihoods. But anyway, if you understand that pizza comes from giving food to people who need food, you will never do anything wrong to get pizza. If you understand the dependent origination of pizza, you will never hurt anyone to get pizza. And then you will never collect bad karma about pizza. And desire, wrong desire or stupid desire, is desire that would hurt someone else to get pizza. And that kind of stupid desire must be based in ignorance. Must have ignorance as its basis. And that's why in the middle of the Wheel of Life, the pigeon's rear end comes out of the pig's mouth. Okay? Because you must have ignorance to collect bad karma. You must have ignorance to have desire. You cannot have desire, stupid desire, if you understand the dependent origination of that object. If you know it's coming from good karma, you're not about to hurt someone to get it. It would be a contradiction of terms. I'll say it again. If you know that pizza comes from good karma, assuming you like pizza, okay? If pizza makes you sick, it's coming from bad karma, okay? Seriously. But if you know it's coming from good karma, it's a contradiction of terms to hurt someone to get it. To do anything wrong to get it. And then that would be ignorance. No, it's
not. Well, you get indigestion from it, but you may not, but I do, right?
Yeah,
yeah. So, by the way, that's another proof of its,
that's another proof of its emptiness. It is not self-existently good or bad. You know? If it was, everyone would like it or everyone would hate it. It's empty.
So stupid desire is wanting something based upon self-existence. What would be non-stupid desire?
That's a good question. Who wants to know if there is such thing as non-stupid desire? Okay, theoretically, of course, any other desire that's not motivated by ignorance. So what about some kind of very, what His Holiness calls self-interested, what's he called? Self-interested, enlightened self-interest. Enlightened self-interest. Which is, okay, I would like to live in a realm where every object there gives me the same reaction that pizza happens to give me personally. Okay? And you undertake those virtuous deeds that are necessary to do that. So virtue or good deeds can be two kinds. What? You can do stupid good deeds. Seriously. You can do good deeds because not understanding emptiness and not understanding the penalty. Those are called stupid good deeds. They have a problem. There's a problem with those good deeds. What's wrong with their result? It wears out. Okay? The difference between stupid good deeds and intelligent good deeds is that stupid good deeds wear out. Our bodies are a result of stupid good deeds. Your salary is a result of stupid good deeds. Assuming you make money. Okay? Every nice thing in your life right now is a result of a stupid good deed. And it will wear off. Okay. Then you have to learn how to do an intelligent good deed. And that's called doing virtue with wisdom. And that's the difference between perfections and non-perfections. For those of you who study the six perfections, the difference between an enlightened good deed and an ignorant good deed is whether or not they're perfections. Perfection means, do you have the perfection of wisdom while you're doing this? That's all. Jan has been very patient. I hope you forgot the question. Yeah? No? If you want to get technical, it's a projection based on some sense data. There is a round red thing appearing to you. Technically, there is some sense data. It's very subtle, and I'll tell you the difference. And you're both right, okay? That's nice. The gardener says, "Mate matakwa." You know, if you don't go too deep, you know, "Mate matakwa." The gardener says, "Mate matakna." If you don't go too deep, not humayi. I'm just a farmer. It's like Max Yazgar got up at Woodstock. I'm a farmer. Now the gardener says, "I'm a farmer," meaning, if you don't go too deep, there is some sense data being presented to you. There is a round red thing that smells a certain way. There's a round red thing that smells a certain way. Projection means your mind, due to the influence of your past karmic imprints, organizes that data into a thing called pizza. And that's what imputation means. Mingde taksam. Imputation means your mind organizes it and calls it pizza. And thinks of it as pizza. But we talked about this in Philadelphia 2 weeks ago. But if a roach came in and stepped on the side of this big round red thing, he would see it as one of the hell realms and one of those metal burning plates over which he has to run, you know. And assuming it's very hot, okay? No, for an ant or a roach, it's a life threatening red round thing. And to you it's a mouth watering red round thing. And your karma is forcing you to see it as pizza. And his karma is forcing him to see it as incredible suffering. And that's true. And that's the emptiness of the bread round thing. Okay. So then in that sense, you're right. Okay, now when you change levels, sense data exists independently. Or is that also a projection? Now is Nitya right? Yeah, but when you go down to the red round thing, is your mind, are there projections forcing you to see red and round, or is red and round really empirically, objectively exist there? And is every sentient being in the universe who looked at that would see red and round, whether or not they interpret it as a pizza or not, you know, whether or not they see it as a hell realm floor or a nice pizza. But what about the red and round? Would every sentient being in the universe who encounters this thing see redness and roundness? Because if they would, then you're right. And if they wouldn't, then maybe Nitya's right. That's wrong. There is something there if you don't go too deep. That's what the gardener would say. But if you keep going down levels, you're going to hit your nose on the floor. And so you can't solve this debate, okay? I'm just telling you that. And in fact, you're not supposed to go much deeper into it in a public call. Okay? But I'll just say that. Matat machepar, unexamined, there is a red round thing there. And that sense that exists there empirically. If you look for the thing which is really there, below all the levels somewhere, manye, you won't find anything. Okay, we better stop it then.
So, you know, the stupid desire. So you go out and you're not thinking about you're going to hurt somebody to have a piece of pizza. You're just walking by the pizza shop and you say, "Oh, a piece of pizza, that'd be nice. I'll have a piece of pizza." Yeah. Is that stupid desire or not stupid desire?
Is it based on ignorance about the pizza? There's a thing called background ignorance, okay? No, seriously. You know, they say if one of the other two poisons is not actively present, manifest, winsome, wundigirpa, in your mind, there's always this background ignorance. And in fact, that background ignorance is responsible for all the parts of your world which are neutral. It's very interesting. The bad deeds are responsible for all the yelling bosses. The good deeds are responsible for all the nice pizza. But what about all that, you know, that background static called New York City, you know, that you don't feel one way or the other about it? They say that's a karmic result of background ignorance, which is always going on in your mind. And it's kind of this low-level misunderstanding of the whole world as you go through it. It's not like an active, it's not like you're going to kill somebody, but it's just this kind of active not understanding your world. And that creates the neutral things of your future. One more, and then we'll take a break.
Well, the peace, but like permanent things we talk about, you know? Are they also your projections?
Anything. There's nothing that's not. In fact, the day that you look down and see a golden, shining body of a Buddha, it'll be a projection. But by that time, you'll be so smart that you'll be perpetuating it all the time. Knowingly, consciously. No problem. Okay? What's wrong with that? I mean, it seems kind of artificial, but it's for real. It's just, it's more purposeful. It's on purpose. And you know what's going on, right? That's fine. So anyway, what's the difference between, is there a thing such as wise desire? This is John's question. We got to get back to it. Is there a sort of thing called wise desire? Of course. You know, we're always talking about the boss and not reacting negatively to the boss. But what about nice things? How are you supposed to react to nice things? Okay. The way to use emptiness to destroy anger at your boss is that as he screams at you, you think he's empty. Does that help remove your boss screaming? No. Does that make you feel better right then? No. You know, and people can tell you, oh, your boss is just a bunch of atoms. You know, he's just a bunch of ions and electrons. You know, no problem. But it never worked for me, you know. I mean, I've had people explain emptiness to me and say, oh, it just means that everything can be reduced to electrons and protons, so why are you going to be mad at a pile of electrons and protons? You know, but that's not the point. I'm being forced to perceive it as a screaming boss that hurts me. It hurts me. So that how to react with wisdom then is to see that if you react with, he's empty, other people in the room are enjoying him, if you wanted to enjoy him, you should have collected good karma in the past. Okay. And so what would be the stupidest thing to do to a yelling boss?
Yell back.
That's exactly the only way to get a yelling boss in your future life. You know, if you want a yelling boss in your future life, get pissed off at your boss when he yells at you. Because that's the only, according to Buddhism, it's the only way to get a yelling boss. Okay. It's the only method to get a yelling boss. But I think what John's saying, what's an intelligent reaction to pleasure? Well, we don't cover that very often. We don't talk about it very often. You know, what are you supposed to do when something nice happens? How are you supposed to react to that? And that's the whole question here. You're supposed to not have this kind of stupid desire. You're supposed to have intelligent desire. What would an intelligent desire say to nice people?
Thank you.
No, you're not eating. And understand its emptiness. Enjoy it and understand its emptiness. What is its emptiness? It's being forced on me by my past karma. I'm enjoying it because I was good in my past life. I mean, eating a pizza should be an experience in reveling in your virtue. It would be an experience of rejoicing in virtue. And if you're on the bodhisattva track, what? I'm eating this to get some calories into my body so I can serve people for the next few hours. You have to think that. If you don't think that, you break a bodhisattva vow. It's not one of the 64 vows. It's one of the overall vows. It's one of the overall commitments of the bodhisattva track. That you are not allowed to experience clothing, or a building, or a subway, or a taxi, or a drink of water, or a toilet, or your Cheerios in the morning, without thinking, I'm doing this for other beings. So that's experiencing it intelligently. You know, you're aware that this is the result of my past good karma. And I would like it to continue. And you just consciously, purposely, set up the causes in the future to perpetuate it. So it's not wrong to like nice things. I mean, they don't describe Buddha fields as places where there's little poopy things and then neutral things and then nice things, and the beings there have gained some incredible ability to put up with all of it, you know, and be neutral. They don't describe Buddha fields like that. It's like this incredibly beautiful, wonderful, blissful thing going on there. I mean, that's the. If Buddhism meant the other thing, you know, Buddhism meant, oh, you have to learn to put up with nice things and bad things and neutral things and feel the same all the time. If that was the goal of Buddhism, then a Buddha field would be what? It'd be a big potpourri of lousy things and neutral things and nice things, and Buddhas would be these incredible beings who could just take it all with some kind of incredible neutrality. You know, I don't care, hit me again, you know. It's not the truth. It's not the way it is. It's not the way to describe Buddha fields. You know, read any sutra, they're not like that. The goal is to reach a place of bliss which you know how to make it happen, and you can keep it like that, and you can teach other people to get there, and that's it. And that's not stupid design. Now, there's three like meanings to the word sangyam. Sangyam means equanimity, and there's soa sangyam, dhruti sangyam. There's different meanings of sangyam. But basically, it means, it doesn't mean that we want to reach a state. It doesn't mean that a Buddha field is a place where bad things are happening, but you've learned to be totally neutral. It doesn't mean that. In the teachings on neutrality or something like that, it means you are understanding the emptiness of your friends and understanding the emptiness of your enemies, and you're learning to feel equally towards them. And that's all. The reaction is equal. Is the incoming data equal? No. I mean, friends look nice and enemies look stupid, you know. But the outgoing karma is equal. You know, you're equal to all of them. That's equanimity. That's dukkha samvara. All right, we'll stop there for about 10 minutes. What's the difference between those two? You have to study samvara. One is an absence of something. The other is a presence of something. One is the fact that if you stripped away from the world everything that was not self-existent, there wouldn't be anything left. And you would just be emptiness. And the other is saying what things are is your projections forced on yourself by your past deeds. Now, the word projection is very, very delicate. It's not my intention to talk about emptiness in this class. And don't misunderstand it. Don't think that you can go stand out in front of a car and the projection won't squash you. You know, it will. You know, and especially don't think that this idea about projections means that things are illusory or they're not real or they don't mean anything and you can do whatever you want, go to bed, don't have any difference. Don't ever think that. Totally wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
We'll get into it sometime. Anyway, I gave you some clues about the meaning of the three poisons. And nyambo, antidote, means that by understanding these things more thoroughly than you do at this moment, you would be able to overcome your mental afflictions, which is your disease. And the supreme physician is the Buddha. Okay? And the treatment is mainly seeing emptiness, but also all the Buddha's teaching. Okay? But the main treatment is, you cannot apply what I've talked about tonight to stop your three poisons exactly or properly until you see emptiness directly. Okay. And that's another story. But that the disease is the three poisons. And I just wanted you to get a flavor between what Buddhist desire or the word desire of Buddhism really means and what I think you might have thought. You know, you see some guy up on a mountain and he looks like he could care less about pizza. Or something like that. And is that what you want? You know, is that what you want to become? That's the goal of Buddhist practice. And that's just something that I throw out to think about. Study the definition as given in the Prajnaparamita. And maybe you'll understand more. It all hinges on understanding that object's emptiness or not. If you could go through life practicing with perfection, and a perfection is a perfection when you do it without ignorance. Okay? Is it really important? Because they all want to go home.
I don't know. Respond to me.
Okay.
Is it useful to think
about whether liking and disliking has its own emptiness?
Sure, absolutely. If they didn't have their own emptiness, you couldn't get rid of them. All right, so I'm going to go through it pretty much straight through the homework because we don't have much time. Name three important reasons why we should make great efforts in the practice of purifying ourselves. Okay, at the end of the four forces. By the way, I'm not going to go much into the fourth force, which is what? Restraining yourself, because that's pretty obvious. Not doing it is pretty obvious. Okay. He doesn't go into it that much either. It's like a single verse or two verses. But what he does go into at the end, he gives a bit of a summary. Like, what's the use of doing the four forces? Why should we do the four forces? And he gives three reasons. And I think they're really cool. So I'm going to write them in Tibetan, and then we'll explain them. Say, Lendeki.
Lendeki.
Namela.
Namela.
Nikepa.
Nikepa.
Lende means, le means karma, de means its consequences. I like to call it actions and their consequences. Actions and their consequences. The rules of karma. The laws of karma. Namye means all the different divisions of karma. All the different details about karma. Is Namye. Lami Kepa means we are not very well versed in this. We don't understand it very well. Okay. That's the first reason why we have to do the four forces. We just don't understand what's right and wrong very well. You know, you pretty much have to be enlightened to understand perfectly the consequences of every single tiny thought you could ever have. And to understand why every dot is here in this ceiling. You know, what karma has created every single little dot. You pretty much have to be enlightened. It's considered one level of difficulty above the emptiness itself. Understanding the laws of karma perfectly is considered shinjukokyo, which means one level of difficulty higher than seeing emptiness itself. Okay, it's very difficult. Only an enlightened being can really see all the connections. So that's the first reason why it's important to know how to do the four forces. Purification is important because of the fact that karma is so difficult to understand. Purification.
Oh,
yes. The first reason why purification is so important is that people like you and me, we just cannot grasp all the laws of karma. They're just too subtle. You know. What result karmically will I get because my tongue touched the corner of the straw, you know, and I had this fleeting impression in my mind? What will be the karmic result of that impression, of that imprint on my mind? You have to pretty much be enlightened to understand. It's beyond most human beings. In fact, in the scriptures it says you cannot perceive that directly in our condition. You have to depend on the words of an enlightened being to understand karma at all. All right. Say, Chuse, Shekyang, Dolan, Tsushindu, Nichepa. This is very simple. It means, okay, we may understand a little about karma, but we are not capable in our current condition of doing the right thing about it. And that's the second reason why you need the four forces, okay? Which is that, okay, you and I have studied a little bit, we understand a little bit about karma, but we can't control ourselves. Okay. If you want to know the words, Jungsei means a bit. Shekyang means you may understand, but. Dorlen means to do what you should do and to not do what you shouldn't do. To do what you should do and not to do what you shouldn't do. Dor means to give up the things you should give up. Len means to take up the things that you should take up. It's called giving and taking. Giving up and taking up. Dor means giving up. Len means taking up.
We understand a little bit more capable of applying it.
Yeah. Which is different from the first one, which was that we really don't grasp all the laws of karma, can't. That leads to the second vision where we are people like with 90% of the vision going and we're trying to do the right thing without really being able to. The implication of number two is that you are constantly collecting bad karma. Okay? Every minute, every second, we are collecting bad karma. We have to know the four forces. We have to know how to short-circuit bad karma, because people like you and me can't keep ourselves from doing bad karma. I mean, if we could stop doing bad karma, you wouldn't need the four forces in one sense. You get rid of the old bad karma, and then you could throw out all the four forces papers. You don't need them anymore. But our condition is that, A, we don't understand karma very well, and B, even a little bit we understand, we can't control ourselves. And you keep collecting bad karma constantly. I have lots of people say, they come to class, they say, I heard you get up and say, I could change my reality if I could purify myself. And I went home and I did all that stuff for like 3 or 4 days, and nothing happened, you know. You know, nothing happened. Or you get older students saying, you know, I do budget stuff for every third week or a couple weeks, and I tried. I really tried pretty hard. I even did it every day, and nothing much happened. You know, nothing really happened. And that's because your mind is collecting new bad karma at an incredible rate. I mean, a fantastic rate. And you know, it's like putting your finger in a dam, you know, and the whole dam is crumbling. You know, I mean, you know, it's like the collection of bad karma is done on a moment-to-moment basis. And the purification is done, you know, half-assed every third day or something. And they don't equal each other, and then your life doesn't change, and you say, oh, you get tired of Buddhism, and you stop coming to class, and you do something else, you do yoga for a while or something, you know. And that's, no offense to but I mean, it's not gonna, you have to give it an honest shot, and you have to be aware also that it's not gonna much change until you can really, the mind is collecting bad karma at an incredible rate, and the purification has to be just as serious, and just as well applied, and 90% of people will not apply it that way, and they won't get much results, and their world won't change much, and then they won't have much faith in Buddhism. If you really work hard at it, you can notice changes in your life and your world within a decent amount of time. It'll start to happen, and you can notice it. It'll start to happen. And if it's not happening, it's probably because the rate of collecting new bad deeds is so powerful. Seriously, no joke. Yes.
How do you distinguish between what's happening? Does it have to do with how you then think about whatever those bad things that are happening?
Yeah, I see what you mean. She says, but you said in the last class, if you do purification well, all these bad things are going to happen to you. But like you're covering your rear end both ways. You know? If your role gets better, it's because you did purification. If your role gets worse, it's because you did purification. You know? the second part stops. It starts to slow down. I mean, there's some few disasters, and you wear out the old bad karma, and assuming you don't collect it at a new and a good rate, it starts to drop. So there's a peak, you know, there's a peak of where you're wearing out. The purification is triggering old bad karma, and then because they are dying out, and because you're applying the fourth force so well, the bad things start to slow down, and then they stop. It's like that. So there is a, what do they call that? There's a peaky. There's a peak thing, and then you wear out the old bad karmas, and then they start to noticeably wear out, and your life noticeably starts to change for the better.
Half life.
Yeah. Okay.
Can you
listen. Can I say that there? Tsu shintu means in the proper way. Nijeta means you can't do or you don't do. Meaning, even though you understand a little bit about the laws of karma, you're unable to do the right thing with regard to what you should do and what you shouldn't do. Okay? That's the second reason why we need the four forces. We are just incapable of not collecting a lot of bad karma from moment to moment. Okay?
conscious.
You don't have to be conscious of it to be collecting it. It's worth if you're conscious of it. Okay. I mean, consciously conscious of it. You have to be aware of, at some subconscious level of it for to collect it at all. But you don't have to, like if you're not thinking about squashing bugs as you walk across a lawn, you're collecting, you're still collecting the karma of killing them. But it's much less than if you were going like, hey, hey, hey. Third reason to do the four forces. Which is the whole reason we brought it up in the first place. Why don't we what's the reason for the first three, four classes? We try to get bodhicitta. So the last reason that you should do the four forces frequently is that Changsa means bodhicitta, a wish for enlightenment. Kyewe means to develop it, to be able to develop it. Gek means obstacle. Jong means to remove it. So the third reason to, and the most important reason, and the reason why it came up in Master Shantideva's text, is that it's supposed to clear away the obstacles to reaching the state of mind where you can love other people as much as you love yourself, which is the great holy grail of our class. You know, this is, if two or three people in this class are able to do everything right, you will reach this blissful state of caring about other people as much as you care about yourself. And that's just this great goal of our class. You know, if one person in this class can do that, then that's worth it. You know? And to imagine what that feels like, it's almost you can't imagine it. But you have to do the four forces to get to remove the obstacles to that. Must do that. Okay, we're running a bit late due to all this cake. Okay. Not me, right? We finished the subject of how to remove obstacles in general to getting bodhicitta. Now you need to collect some positive energy. It's like you sweep the room, and now you try to get some positive energy in the room. All the classes up to now have been sweeping the room, cleaning out the negativities in your mind that will block you from reaching that kind of compassion. But now you have to collect some positive energy. What we call tumken, right? Tumken. Conducive conditions. Conditions that help bodhicitta grow. It's like you've dug up the field and rototilled it. And now, okay, what are we going to do? You know, what kind of fertilizer, what kind of water, what kind of sunlight? What are the nice things we need to get bodhicitta after you clean out all the poo-poo, okay? And here, there's five of them. And I'll go through them real fast. And I'm going to make them a little bit, I'm going to put them in their short forms. You know?
Yeah.
The long form is Gerala Jisimirawa, okay? But it means to be happy about the good things that you and other people are doing, period. Just to be happy about them. To take some kind of joy in them. And that's the first one. Take joy in the good things that you and other people are doing. Shantideva describes three levels of good things, and it's on your homework, okay? First thing is anything good that you or other people are doing to get yourself to a higher realm. Like, for example, to stay a human, okay? All the good things that you or other people are doing that would keep you in the higher realm, you should be happy about. That's called first level rejoicing. First level rejoicing. That's mostly doing good deeds, avoiding the 10 bad deeds like that. Okay? Second level rejoicing about all the things that you're doing and other people are doing that would get you to nirvana alone. Okay? Nirvana alone. Only nirvana. That means anything you or other people do which is going to remove permanently your mental affliction. Okay? the greatest deed there, the most effective one, would be seeing emptiness directly. Like, if you've heard that someone has seen emptiness directly, or you have seen emptiness directly, rejoice, be happy. By the way, two kinds of rejoicing, right? You can be happy about what you did, and you can be happy about what other people did. The scriptures all say, and it's very weird, they're all the same. It says you can get exactly 10% of other people's good karma by just being happy about what they did. You know, it's very weird that all the scriptures would say, you know, not 11% and not 9%, you know, say.